The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
Politics Weekly, I'm Hugh Muir. Last week it was Gove versus May, this week it's May versus Cameron and Boris Johnson. With 9 months to go until the election, are the Tories losing the plot? Live and let live, brotherly love, minding the gap, making the best of things. What are British values? The Education Secretary demands more Britishness in the classroom. But what can we teach, and will it work? And the wait is over. Yes, World Cup fever hits Westminster. What is it about football and politics? Joining me for all of this is our first team, if you would like. The Guardian columnist Anne Perkins, our education editor Richard Adams, and the director of the British Future think tank Sundar Katwala. Welcome to all of you. Well, another week, another media maelstrom surrounds Home Secretary Theresa May. No sooner had she waved goodbye to her special advisor after that spat with Michael Gove than she was battling with Boris Johnson over water cannon and now trying to keep a lid on the chaos at the passport office. Anne Perkins, is this a case of bad luck coming in threes, or is Theresa May succumbing to the job of Home Secretary, which all Home Secretaries tend to do?
She's beginning to look a little bit accident-prone, but then, on the other hand, this kind of sequence of events produces all the qualities that she's admired for. You know, she's so calm, you don't necessarily know that she's awake. She never gets rattled. She doesn't laugh a lot. And she exudes this air, generally, of competence, and nobody has yet managed to exactly stick the blame on her, although the smoking gun over the release of the letter to Michael Gove did seem to be awfully close to her desk.
Is this happening because we're just paying more attention to her?
No, I think the Home Office is a notorious propagator of domestic crises. I mean, the extraordinary thing is there have been so few on her watch, and I don't think any of these, I mean, easily the most significant is obviously the one about how you handle extremism. I think the passport, I bet, has got a much more, passport issue has got a much more complicated past, which will be to do with staff cuts and, you could put it down to increasing prosperity. Anyway, it's an agency. She can remove herself from that. The most interesting one may be the spat with Boris over water cannon, and that, I think, the jury's still out.
Sundar, on our rain lash island, you come between a Britain and their holiday at your peril, don't you? They've got to sort this passport thing out, haven't they?
I think so, because, you know, also saying sort of crisis, what crisis? Never the thing. Never the thing
it's
for the politicians
the
in charge
to be heard
saying. But that is the famous curse of being Home Secretary, that you're responsible for all of this stuff and it's going to go wrong. But Theresa May, this remarkable ability to sort of beat the jinx. And it's, you know, it is a bit of a mystery sometimes. You know, all sorts of things going wrong in policing, and she got something very positive actually out of taking that on, miles away from hitting your immigration target, but you've got this reputation for being resolute. So she looks like a lucky politician as Home Secretary, and that's a rare thing to be.
Richard Adams, we know that David Cameron doesn't much like reshuffles, and of the potential candidates, we'll talk about Michael Gove in just a moment, but do you get a sense that discipline's starting to break down?
I don't think I do. I mean, it seems to be mainly sort of still outward looking. So you've had this recent fight between the Department for Education and, say, Nick Clegg about who was responsible for cocking up the figures about free school lunches. And now you've had another one between the DfE and Ofsted, Sir Michael Wilshaw, who for some reason went on television and claimed that he had wanted to introduce no-notice inspections of schools and it had been blocked by the Secretary of State, which was not true, and he then had to back down. So it's still sort of the discipline is there, and they've got their targets. But I mean, between May and Gove, as we saw last week, there's a little bit of an issue about, you know, who can be tougher on extremism.
But there was also that argument, wasn't there, between Gove and Clegg about which of them came up with the pupil premium as well. And when they're squabbling amongst themselves, Anne Perkins, it doesn't look good. You're not getting big vision politics then, are you?
Well, do you know, I hesitate to say this. It probably isn't at all the right answer. But I don't think anyone outside Whitehall will notice who's squabbling. I think they'll hear Clegg if they're aware that there's a dispute over it, because the one thing that Clegg's done consistently is try to appropriate all the scores, and to some extent he's been allowed to. But I just think this is the kind of sort of thing that we find completely fascinating, and most other people think is really not what politics ought to be about.
Sundar Dibadat, aren't we always being told that divisive governments are unsuccessful or don't get re-elected?
I think you have to divide between two different things. The coalition needs to organise a conscious uncoupling, or whatever Gwyneth Paltrow would call it, because we're at the last year going into the election. But it's the divided party that you worry about. The Conservative Party, I think, remarkably calm 3 or 4 weeks after a European election that UKIP won, when they're meant to be in the throes of a civil war. And actually, the result they got in the Newark by-election, they're very calm about that, and actually a lot of the wobbling, I think, is on the Labour side at the moment.
Okay, well, we mentioned Michael Gove earlier, and in fact it's impossible to talk about politics at the moment without talking about Michael Gove. He seems unable to keep himself off the front pages. This week he received a report he'd commissioned into allegations of extremism in Birmingham State schools. In the end, the most serious allegations were not substantiated, but inspectors did find reason to believe that there were organised campaigns to undermine head teachers. Richard Adams, I know you've been across this story. Just give us a quick flavour of how we got to where we are.
Well, in November last year, a letter supposedly written by somebody at the head of or involved in a plot to take over or subvert a number of schools in Birmingham, supposedly wrote a letter to some colleagues in Bradford suggesting the tactics that have worked in Birmingham.
The Trojan Horse letter.
Which used the phrase Trojan Horse, and that's now become the Trojan Horse letter. And what happened to the letter after that is very interesting. It sort of bounced around inside Birmingham Council for a bit, and eventually someone forwarded it to the Home Office, who then forwarded it to the DfE, and that was in November, and then nothing happened for a bit until it was eventually made public at the end of February. And that set this whole thing off, and then we've now got four investigations underway, one of which was the results of which have just been published by Ofsted, and that looked at 21 schools in Birmingham that were supposedly involved in this plot. The allegation being that Muslim governors were taking over school boards and then putting pressure on head teachers to embrace elements of Islam within the school, and if they resisted that, then they were pushed out. I'd say most of that hasn't been substantiated. There's certainly nobody's seen any signs that there's a concerted plot. The aims of whatever there was of a plot varies. Some people think this was some attempt to introduce extremism into these schools, but in fact it just appears to be religious conservatives who were trying to introduce policies into these schools. I mean, some of which were things like halal food and various other concessions. There is at least one of these schools seems to have gone seriously off the rails. But the remaining 20, five were pretty much cleared of anything, and five were deemed to have put their pupils at risk. And a very curious phrase: the risks associated with exposure to extremism. And that they had exhibited weak governance, and they were placed in special measures. And the remaining 10 were had pretty minor things. So it boils down to really, you know, five schools in Birmingham, which one was sort of obviously this is a school called Old Knowe Primary, where they decided that spending about £50,000 of school funds sending 40 primary school children to Mecca was a good idea.
So, Nkawala, I suppose in this, as in all things in terms of how we all live together, you're the voice of sanity in this. You've heard and you've seen all of the headlines and heard all of the allegations. What is it that's left that worries you?
What struck me about the whole affair, and you know, quite murky to work out what's really going on, is that some people always knew what they thought was going to go on. There's an Islamist plot, or there's this all a plot by Islamophobes to go and, you know, pick on Muslims. As Rich has just described to us, quite a nuanced picture once you look and find out what's going on. You know, one school with a lot of problems, some schools are completely, you know, complete bill of clean health and so on. And some things, you know, some more nuanced things to sort out in the middle. So I think what we need is we need an inspections regime that we trust to go in and find out is what is going on and put things in place. And they tend to be things of, you know, the governors having too strong a role and not letting the head teacher do the job. But, you know, some of those things at ordinary primary schools mentioned, or if people are saying, because of the type of school this is, or because of the type of pupils we've got, we'd like to downgrade music from the curriculum, then you've really got to have a clear system that says, no, we don't do that. And that should be done in the name of parents generally. It's harder, I think, you know, in a mixed city like Birmingham, if you've got a school which is not a faith school, it's a community school, but it's 98% British Muslim, because you're having to bring people up to share the city, share the country they share. But you're almost having to simulate that because you've got a single community in the school. And actually, most parents from most backgrounds don't want that. So actually, we should also ask, what are the dynamics that make that happen?
I'm going to ask you in a minute just to give us some sense of what sort of British values we might try to impart in the classroom. And Richard, maybe you can talk about whether or not that's actually possible. But Anne, first of all, what about the politics of this? How has this been handled in terms of Michael Gove and the Prime Minister just making sure and reassuring the country that there's not something very disturbing happening there?
Curiously, I wonder if all the different dynamics at work in this haven't actually lessened, softened the potentially very damaging impact of having a cabinet minister apparently backed by the Prime Minister, you know, suspecting that there was that this conveyor belt approach that says that, you know, if you are a religious conservative, you are potentially going to develop into a violent extremist. And that's an awful and deeply serious and important thing to say. And it needs examining and deconstructing, but it's been so shrouded in the secondary argument about who's jostling for position, whether it's partly about a different contest about who's tougher on extremism, whether it's about trying to suppress May's leadership ambitions or expose May, or indeed the reverse. All of these things have clouded the substance of the debate. I think Cameron came in and he did knock heads together and he did shut people up. And I guess, you know, if you think about the implications of that, it means that Cameron does still, although he allowed this to get out of control in the first place, he does still have the power to get his cabinet in line, at least for the short term.
It's all been pretty unedifying, hasn't it?
It's not been, I don't think it's been at all good. But I think Sunder's right. I mean, the Tory party is in unexpectedly good shape. And I think this is true in England generally, despite the European Parliament election results. And I think it's proven to be more resilient than one might expect.
Sundar, first of all, can you confirm for us that you're not going to change the name of your organisation to British Values Future?
No, British Future, we're very happy with. But I, you know, I don't like this sneering at the idea that we, you know, we would never be able to find British values, and it's absolutely absurd. Because actually, if you get out there and ask people, there's an enormously broad consensus on what British values are and what they should be. And if you actually ask people what's number one for them, it's respect for the freedom of speech of other people when you don't agree with them. And that goes with, you know, all the mother and apple pie things of the rule of law and actually respect for all faiths and respect for all ethnicities. And so we've evolved into that. So there's no problem finding out what the British values are and finding out that people across different faith backgrounds hold them. Now, the difficulty is, now how do we go and teach that in schools? Saying, here is the list of British values, it is tolerance, it is fair play, and we will teach them in schools, you know, doesn't kind of get you there. And that's where the previous government got stuck as well. And what I do is I'd root it much more in the history of how we got to the values. We got religious tolerance from civil wars and religious intolerance. And so we, you know, we tried the alternatives and we found out that this would work. How did we get to a multi-ethnic society that we share? We got there through empire decolonisation, but that is a shared history. And if we're scared, actually, of the conflict that got us through the British values, and, you know, things that are emotionally resonant to the majority population have a lot of ethnic diversity in them. The armies that fought the First War 100 years ago, they look more like the Britain of 2014 than the Britain of 1914, but that would surprise all sorts of people in the classroom of 14-year-olds. So why don't we show how we got to the values of tolerance and democracy? You know, it took some time.
But if I say I want my idea of tolerance is that I don't want my daughter to be taught sitting next to boys in the class. I can say that that's me adhering to British values, and you'll presumably say that's me not adhering to British values.
Then you've got to have the conversation about where the boundaries are. I mean, in the school, you put the boundaries quite strongly on the side of the chance for those children to be, you know, educated about the faith they hold. It's very important they know about all of the other faiths and people don't believe, and they need the space, don't they, to think critically. So if you say, my values, my religion means I'm taking you out of English because I don't want you to learn Shakespeare, then, you know, I'd be looking for people from whatever religious background you're from to say, well, that's not, I don't recognise it, sorry, don't impose that. Of course there are strong intolerant strains of all of the religions, and occasionally someone will come in and try and amend the science curriculum because they're an evangelical Christian, and you protect the education we've got. We have faith education in this country. You know, we're not France. And so actually we've got to work out how to make that work in a setting where there will be faith-based education, how you make that work for a multi-faith society.
Richard Adams, are we looking at a mess up here? Because what Sundar's saying is eminently sensible in that you have to have some rules, and some of them will have to be tough rules and people won't like them. Presumably that means that you should have laid down those rules at the outset. So why are we still discussing this? We have these schools, they've been established, the framework's established. Shouldn't all of this have been done ages ago?
Well, if it was that simple, everyone would do it, I think, is the answer. I mean, British values, say, for example, strikes for me, it's a bit like the Supreme Court's definition of the U.S. Supreme Court's definition of pornography. You know it when you see it, but it's hard to, you know, and that's true. It strikes me that British values is something that it's hard to teach explicitly, but it comes into the way that you teach things. So, you know, teaching freedom of speech is difficult to do in itself, but having freedom of speech is something that people exhibit. In the case, I mean, in the more sort of structural question, the case of academies, I mean, the point of academies and free schools was that they were supposed to be freed from restrictions, and that parents and governors would have far greater choice, that they were best, you know, equipped to judge what was best for their community in their schools.
Isn't that exactly what's happening in Birmingham?
And that's exactly what's happening in Birmingham. Now, we can look at a sliding scale of things. So, for example, a school that is 98 or 99%, in the case of Oldknow, 99% Muslim, you know, serving halal food, obviously, would be, you know, what's wrong with that? No problem. Or having, it would be ludicrous to have a Christian act of worship required by law, as it is in most state schools. It'd be slightly ludicrous to have that in a school where almost all of the pupils were Muslim. So, you know, one can look at these things and examine them individually and say, well, that's all right, and that's all right, and that's all right. And then what seems to happen is that a collection of these things come together and people suddenly said, oh, that seems to be too much. And that's the problem here.
But I think Hugh's kind of put his finger on the really next to the conveyor belt thing. The other really difficult thing, and the thing that arguably fell apart this week, is Gove's whole speedy process of academisation, and his conflicting idea that you can simultaneously let 1,000 flowers bloom and have a kind of sort of rigid controls over, governed from Whitehall, of what these schools can and can't do in the classroom. There clearly has to be a balance between those, and the structures aren't there to police or monitor them. I think Oster's put itself in a really, I suspect, and anticipating this problem, they've tried to sort of second guess the politicians, I fear, and I think they have compromised to some extent their independence, and I think Wilshaw's got a big battle to re-establish it. And it's quite clear that for the last 4 years, the right's been gunning for Ofsted and have felt that it was too much part of the establishment and not good enough at driving up standards. And I think they're going to be under a lot of pressure in the next year or so. I can imagine Gove really trying to shove the buck in their direction.
I mean, some of that is because Ofsted, in its examinations of free schools, for example, has been tepid in its enthusiasm, and that only in the sense that the inspection reports it's produced has found a number of free schools that are not particularly good. So they're not the unalloyed success that the DfE would like them to be. And that's, there's been suggestions that somehow Ofsted have some sort of prejudice against free schools and academies.
Let me just broaden it a bit. Sundar, if we're going to have this discussion about values, presumably we're going to have some consensus about what they are, because I suppose the most dangerous thing is if they're just imposed by Michael Gove or by anyone else or by a small group of people on everyone else, because we might not agree. But is there a mechanism by which we can, as a country or as a political establishment, if you like, have that discussion.
I think this is where it's got stuck in the past, because we're not a society of constitutions in that sense. We're an old country, and it does evolve, and it has evolved. And, you know, governments ratify things. You know, it'd be hard to say that gay rights were British value 30 years ago, and now they are when we look to people to uphold them. So you have that evolution. So I think government creates the space for that conversation, has to let it come through. But actually, we look to the media, actually, for a role in that, and actually for some responsibility in
it. You're looking to
us. Well, no, I think we do, and especially the responsible end of the media. I mean, I'll give you an example. I spent last Saturday at the annual meeting of the Islamic Society of Britain, which is, I think, a group that, you know, would very strongly associate with British values and has got beyond the idea of, you know, we have to assert our place in this society, take that for granted, and are looking to contribute and to integrate. So they have groups like British Future or the Christian Muslim Forum kind of there. And those kind of quiet, sincere voices doing good work on integration always will get crowded out once it becomes an enormously polarised whose side are you on and one community's under pressure. And so actually making sure that you're platforming, you know, of course there are a range of views, the religiously conservative views, and there are some quite extreme views, but actually making sure that it isn't a them and us debate, because, you know, British Muslims have been in Britain, you know, in some numbers well over a century, and, you know, are very big and the fastest growing part of our society. Most people born here, grow up here, educated here, and it's the youngest community in our country, and we always go and hear, you know, actually, you know, some of the older members of that community probably kind of police the way in which there's a dynamic of generational change. So actually, it'll be, you know, groups like The Guardian could unlock some of that discussion. You know, what do young Muslim women under 30 think British values are, and the terms on which they get accepted on equal terms to be proudly British and Muslim? We don't hear that voice very often.
Right, so it's our job, The Guardian, people around this table, to sort this out. No pressure.
The first thing I'd do is commission Sunda to write, you know, 1,200 words or maybe 4,000 on what his history curriculum would look like, because I'm really interested in that. And I think that's such an important way of building a sense of how we got here and where we might go from here, and so much more constructive than doing the Second World War again and, you know, kind of jumping from William the Conqueror via the Tudors to the Second World War, which is the way the history curriculum, particularly one feels as seen through Gove's eyes, ought to go. And it would be it would just be brilliant.
I'll keep the Second World War and the First World War in there. You know, Second
World
War, largest volunteer army in history, the Indian Army.
Yeah,
in the Second World War. You know,
and it's about individual rights, and it's the kind of foundation myth of Britain. Yeah. I'm not saying it's not important, but it's not.
Sure.
But it's not just a European conflict.
So that's some of what we teach. Richard Adams, do the teachers want to teach this stuff?
I mean, this is part of the problem. I mean, schools are being asked to do a lot these days. I mean, they're expected to increasingly to replace the role of parents for reasons of time in many cases. So the school day is expanding so that children go in at breakfast clubs and stay for after school clubs, and you know, holidays get squeezed and so on. So it's increasingly filling a parental role in that respect. And now it's also being asked to do a different job about making pupils into, you know, model British citizens as well. I mean, this is asking a lot of schools, which really are educational institutions and are supposed to be teaching, you know, maths and science and all these less exciting things.
Well, just very quickly, this morning, some girls who I guess must be about year 10 from Elizabeth Garrett Anderson School in central London have been in, and they, you know, ethnically very diverse group, and they were perfectly clear what British values were, and the first thing they say is tolerance and respect for diversity.
Well, that's a hopeful note, and let's lift the spirits still further, because amid this orgy of British values, the World Cup begins. At yesterday's Prime Minister's Questions, it was a surprise that there was time to talk about anything else.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm sure the whole House will wish to join me in wishing the England football team the very best of British before their first World Cup game this Saturday in Brazil.
Will this have some political significance? Why? I know you love football from some of the things you've written for The Guardian, but what is it about football and politics? All politicians seem to need to be able to talk about football almost as a badge of honour.
It's this reaching out and being one of us thing, isn't it? Of course, we know that the, you know, good wishes from Cameron are a curse of gargantuan proportions, which English football probably doesn't really need. But, you know, it's like that same urge they had to identify a favourite group or something. You know, they kind of feel they've got to show they speak the same language as voters, and they're not prepared to admit that maybe they don't.
And of course, it's their mark of authenticity, isn't it? Which also brings that danger, because if they get something wrong, was it Tony Blair who said that he was in the terraces at Newcastle
when Jackie Milburn?
No, Alistair Campbell always denies that.
There is the genuine, you know, kind of feel good factor. I mean, imagine. I mean, I'd hate to think what the consequences for the future of the United Kingdom are if England were to
the Scots.
Well,
the Scots would hold it against us if we won the World Cup.
What do you see? Alex Salmond
said that he would be backing England. What do you think that's about?
I think that's political jujitsu by Alex Salmond. He's trying to say, look, we can have an independent Scotland and still hope that England does well. Yeah, you know, that we can be, you know, as one.
We found actually that Scots are as likely to support England, about 15% of them will say anybody but England. But actually the yes voters are more likely to be supporting Italy, Uruguay and Costa Rica against England, and the no voters will be supporting England. So Salmond actually just sort of, you know, reaching out for the other votes there.
Well, we'll see if those positive vibes from our entire island can help England when they play their first game on Saturday. But that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Sundar Katwala and Perkins and Richard Adams. The producer of this podcast was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. We're back in 2 weeks' time. If you want to keep up with the politics, you can do it on theguardian.com/politics. But that is all that we have time for now. Thank you for listening and goodbye.